Welcome to Alchemist X Innovators Inside, the podcast where we explore the world of corporate innovation and dive deep into the minds of thought leaders, high achievers, and risk takers. I'm your host, Ian Bergman, and together we'll uncover the challenges, triumphs, and secrets behind successful innovation journeys. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur, an industry veteran, or simply curious about the ever-evolving landscape of innovative ideas and what it takes to put them into practice, this is the podcast for you. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's embark on this exciting journey together. Christy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It is a delight to be here, Ian. This is the best way I've figured out to get out one-on-one with you in the last couple of weeks, given all the travel we've been doing.
This is what I get for inviting a colleague onto the podcast. Point well taken. Well, for those who don't know her, Christy Canada is a senior director at Alchemist, and she came on board a little over a year ago and has just been doing incredible work with our product offerings, with our coaching across the board. I'm going to let her sort of talk about her background. But Christy, I'm really excited to have you here so that we can have our one-on-one in front of everyone else and also maybe have a conversation about Alchemist or about innovation.
Well, I would say I've been with Alchemist for about 2 years now. I just came on full time about a year ago.
Well, that's really true. Well, let's use that as a jumping off point. Tell us about yourself. You've got such a cool and kind of eclectic background. So what brings you to Alchemist in this conversation today?
Well, let's see. So my original degree is in biotech from MIT. And I worked in biotech labs, did a short stint in graduate school, realized that in fact, opportunity cost for graduate school was pretty high.
Yep.
The graduate program I was in at Tufts Medical averaged 7.5 years, and I was working in mouse models.
That's a commitment. That's not an 18-month MBA.
No, that is not. And so I realized that, in fact, I did not want to be doing this. And so I dropped out of grad school, which, quite frankly, I think is the smartest thing I did in my early career, and went into large biotech. I did take a short decompression stint working at the New England Aquarium doing necropsies on giant sea mammals, but we can come back to that later if relevant. So we moved out to California, the Bay Area, and I worked at Bayer. Did that for a couple of years. And even though the idea working in biotech is you get quick results, you actually get a product in the hands of an end user.
Sure.
It's still slow. It is still slow, and it's very bureaucratic, and it's highly regulated. So when the opportunity came for me to make the jump to Web 2.0 startup, I said, absolutely, this is a great idea.
Web 2.0, the hot new thing.
Well, when you move to the Bay Area, you are obligated to join a startup. Did you know that there's a thing that they have you sign?
When I've been told. It's a secret contract, though. No one ever actually has shown it to me yet.
So the interesting thing is my husband and his friends from grad school had started a design and consulting firm. And so they did internal projects and took contract work in order to pay the bills. And one of the projects that they built for internal use only was a project sharing tool. Because in graduate school, they had taken up kite surfing and were documenting these things, hard coding the HTML in 2000. With schematics and tutorials, and they take their kite surfing equipment to the beach and break it and then document how it went and make more. Because of course they were at the MIT Media Lab and we had access to an awful lot of really, really cool equipment.
Of course.
That is now much more commonplace, right? Like laser cutters and water jets and things like that. So just built this internal tool and I was posting on it. They were posting on it, all the things we were doing. Everything from recipes to art projects, to LED projects, to kite surfing projects.
I'm guessing there's an epiphany coming here.
Yeah, that was fun. And so we said, oh, here, you know, some friends, you can use this too. And then suddenly the realization dawned that people who we did not know were using it. So at that point, I still had a real job. But we realized that this was potentially a company. And so when it spun out, I decided, you know, I really just am not enjoying this biotech job. I want to do something that is much closer to an end user.
Yep.
And quite frankly, project sharing website, it's a hobby, right? This is a lifestyle company. And that was delightful. So the company was called Instructables. It's still around. We were acquired by Autodesk in 2011. And honestly, we're really a poster child for acquisition, which was a fascinating thing. That was not who we expected to be acquired by. We had met all of the media companies that we thought were going to acquire us over the course of the years between 2005 and 2011 when we finally were acquired. And Autodesk was a little bit of a surprise. But the delightful thing is we were acquired into a bit of a skunk works, a consumer group. And so Autodesk, who makes all the...
Still close to the customer.
Exactly. Who makes all the giant 3D modeling software for professionals had come to the realization that hobbyists also do things, right? All the engineers who use their software professionally, they have hobbies.
They nerd out on the side. Of course they do.
They do. And so all the entry-level software, they also acquired Tinkercad, for example, and they now own Ingle. So all the things that people were using on their side projects, they were trying to figure out how to talk to those people. And as a project sharing and documentation website, we knew all of those people. We were all of those people. And so we came on to help them figure that out.
That's really cool. I want to let you continue here, but you said something interesting. You said a poster child for our acquisition or startup acquisition. What does that mean?
Part of what that means is figuring out how you can work within the larger company.
Yeah, that's tough. These things fail left and right.
Right. Not to say that there were not growing pains, but I think that the fact that we came into a bit of a startup bubble really made the transition much easier. We did have to do things like, say, stop running contests worldwide for a little bit while we, you know what, let's not go into this bit. We're going to stop.
Well, yeah. Well, you worked out the implications.
Yeah. So, but it was really nice to go into a bit of a startup bubble and have a transition period.
Yeah.
And work with other startups. And we had a couple of years to do that. And then we built out Pier 9, which is a really gorgeous workshop space right next to the Exploratorium on the San Francisco waterfront. And so the idea there was to take the professional software with the end users and figure out what that experience looked like. It was really quite fun to see people who were building this software and maybe hadn't touched a machine since they were in college come in and try and use a CNC mill. But the fact that we were really pushing on this meant that some of these connections got made between the end users and the professional users and the writers of the software.
Sure.
And so what we started doing over the course of years was helping bridge those gaps. So I was there for almost 10 years, which was about, I would have expected 2.5, almost exactly.
What's amazing to me about this is you're not framing it in this way, but you're living not just a poster child of sort of acquisition, but you were living a poster child for a form of corporate innovation that entire time, right? You're running internal, external.
Absolutely. It was intentional corporate innovation.
There you go.
Right. So this specific group was put together to try and stretch the idea of what was possible within a large company and specifically move it towards a more flexible, end-oriented, user-oriented company.
Well, the whole theme of this podcast, right, are the trials, challenges, and tribulations and successes of trying to run innovation through the lens of startups. And so you've lived it, right? You've lived through the acquisition, bring it in. Of course, there's pains and growing pains and absorption pains, but you know, you lived the path of hackathons, you lived the path of community engagement, you lived the path of bringing new ideas and technology into a company. And it sounds like it was successful.
Well, big companies are big ships that move very slowly, right? They turn very slowly, but once they get going, they move fast.
Yeah.
And when I look back 10 years later, I would not have imagined the level of change that Autodesk went through in those 10 years. It was really striking. And I spent that 10 years functioning as an agent of change within that company. Kind of the pointy end of the spear for lots of very, very interesting cross-company projects. Helping to work with some of the founders that came in, because Autodesk, like many large companies, does a lot of acquisitions, including full acquisitions and tech transfers.
Yep.
So I did a lot of work that was cross-company, that was aimed at changing culture, that was aimed at changing process and procedures that was aimed at modernization. I will not tell you about the details of integrating GDPR across 256 products, services, and systems all on different stacks. But it got done.
I don't want to hear it, and I don't want to send our audience into a panic.
But nevertheless, the point is, when you bring in a startup to a large company, sometimes it goes sideways.
Yeah.
If you're not intentional. But there are ways to bring change to large institutions. And the things that I saw succeed and the things that I saw fail, they're patterns. And I've seen this across other companies in other industries.
And patterns.
Right. All of us who do this, we talk to each other.
we do. And patterns are replicable to an extent. Mm-hmm. History can predict the future. So let's talk about that, because you also interact with a lot of founders and startups.
Absolutely.
And you have been for a while. So I don't know, how many startups do you think you've talked to in the last 4 or 5 years?
Well, I've probably worked fairly deeply with a couple of hundred.
Yeah, incredible.
And then, of course, we review thousands and we interview, again, hundreds, if not thousands. So I love being at this intersection at Alchemist where I get to see, it's not even right to call it deal flow. Deal flow suggests that I'm looking at this with a VC eye. I'm looking at this with a what's good for society eye. I want to see what's cool and what's neat and what's next.
What's cool, what's neat, and what's next. Okay.
Yeah, I feel like I get to peek into the future.
Well, okay. You just framed up the whole future of the whole next section of our conversation here, because that's really cool. So you've been working with Alchemist for a while. You've joined full time. And as you say, you mm-hmm. talked to hundreds, thousands of startups. And you've also talked with our government and our corporate partners about what they're trying to accomplish in the innovation space.
Right.
So what's cool? What's neat? What's next? Let's talk about this. Where is this drive for what's next coming from, in your view? Like, you've talked to a ton of founders that are building what's needed. You've talked to large organizations that are trying to buy or build or partner around what's needed. Where is this drive coming from?
I think it's an innate human drive. Right? We are curious little primates and we like to go poke at things with sticks.
So the image is in my head. I like it's a curious little primate poking at like a deep blue supercomputer with a stick and like getting shocked. And I think I'm going to like try and get Midjourney to produce an image like that, put it on my business card. But in the meantime, so we like to poke at things with sticks. Okay. So I was having a conversation with someone earlier today that I thought was really, really fascinating. And they asked me a simple question. Is the world of innovation, is it proactive or is it reactive? Meaning, you know, are we sitting there being futurists and envisioning what's possible and setting out and trying to build it? Or are we saying, oh, neat, here's a new tech, here's a new capability. Oh, yikes, here's a problem. And we're reacting to that and trying to solve solutions. So as you look across all these innovation conversations that you have, all of these startup conversations, what do you think? Are the curious primates poking things with stick being proactive or reactive?
Honestly, I think that the people who sit down and have serious business future conversations and you know, isolate themselves and have deep thinky thoughts about the future, change does not come from there.
Yeah.
That is not where things come from. I think that change comes from people who are dissatisfied. And they are trying to fix their problem. They see the possibility of something better. But the idea of the hedonic treadmill, that once you are accustomed to something, it stops being as delightful as it was when it was new, that this is actually a superpower for humans because we constantly want more. We want improvement. We want novelty.
We're never satisfied.
Yeah, we're never satisfied. You get used to it and that becomes your new baseline. And so you have to up the gain.
You know, it is such an interesting concept in the space of innovation. I feel it in, let's say, generative AI, right? Mm-hmm. We've been creating things with DALL-E and Midjourney as a society for what, a year, a little over a year, basically. It has not been that long. And this stuff's become commonplace.
Yeah.
Or we see cars that can almost kind of sort of drive themselves. Not quite, but they're darn close.
And I remember the first DARPA challenges where everyone ended up in the sand dunes. Right? No one made it through.
Yep. No one made it through.
I think this is really cool. And I think that I'm delighted that I get to take for granted the pace of innovation. That feels like a treat.
That is a treat. And it's, I think, sometimes separates those of us that are immersed in this world from, you know, others that are just trying to kind of keep up with the craziness that's changing in their world. But I want to keep going down this path. So I buy your thesis that most innovation comes from challenge, pain, frustration. It comes from these negative emotions.
Well, some of it also, no. Some of it also comes from curiosity.
Okay.
Boredom and curiosity.
Okay.
Right. Because this is, again, why things that are normally seen as negatives are a superpower, right? Hedonic treadmill, oh, that's terrible. People just get so frustrated and annoyed. Ah, yes, but it allows us to do things that, to keep upping our expectations. And then things like various forms of non-neurotypical brains. If you want to go super, super, super deep on something, if you want to really geek out on a specific topic, and then you talk to your friend who has also really, really gone deep on some completely unrelated area, the two of you run into each other and you realize that there's an overlap.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I figured out early on was that the interstitial overlaps is where the really interesting things happen. That's 110% true when it comes to hobbyist projects, right? So if you looked at the things on Instructables that got viral internet pickup, it was the weird stuff, right? It's not, this is the master's thesis robot I built. It's more things like, I learned how to do taxidermy. So I taxidermied a mouse and I put duck feet on it.
Now, is this weird in an inspirational way? Or is this weird in a whoa, like curiosity inducing way? What is it about this stuff that made it go viral? And what did people do with it?
Well, I think this is the sort of thing that captures people's attention, right? Again, little monkey brains, we like novelty. We like the unexpected. That's why jokes work. So our brains are primed for this kind of thing. And right now we have infinite information. So the question is, how do you curate that infinite information in a way that surfaces the things that you need to know when you need to know it? And you can, again, have people who go deep on subjects bounce off each other. Right? You can do the Steve Jobs, let's make all the Pixar people go to the same bathrooms and eat the same cafeteria so that you have those random collisions and that serendipity. Well, you can also do things like do random walks through Wikipedia and just go deep on reading all the weird stuff and then go to sleep. And then the next morning you come up with a crazy idea that should never work, but you're going to try it anyway.
So you've talked to, out of all these startups you're talking to, how many, like ballpark, how many are born from curiosity or opportunity? And how many are born from, yikes, I hate this?
Well, I'll tell you what I am not interested in. Can we start with that?
Yeah, let's do it.
I am not interested in, as an MBA, I have analyzed this segment and I have determined it is under-monetized.
Yep.
That to me is, I will stay far away from that. I will not fund that. I will give you a low score if I am trying to pick an accelerator cohort, because to me, you don't have any skin in the game.
Yeah.
And you don't have a deep understanding. You don't have an unfair advantage there.
So the unfair advantage, because I think that's a really important concept in successful early stage founders. Does that come from that curiosity you were talking about? Does that come from that lived experience?
Well, curiosity gives you deep knowledge, right? Curiosity gives you the opportunity to really dig in and figure out whether it matters to you in some fundamental way. I collect weird data. And if you ask me to give you weird data points, I'm going to just blink. But if something triggers it, I'll go, oh, wait, here's something that's relevant. And that's the way it works, is you just collect all these things. And then when you see a problem that has been festering for a while, you say, all right, we're going to try this. I'm going to solve this problem. This is my problem. One of the programs that I work with that I really enjoy, the Community Safety and Wellness Program in Alberta, Canada. These are all mission-driven companies.
Yep.
You have people who are trying to solve problems around health, around, say, more ethical policing, around safety and security and community management, things like this. All of these are problems that they or their loved ones have faced. These are all things that they care deeply about.
It's a lived experience.
It is direct or indirect experience, right? They have skin in the game. right? Founders who have that lived experience, who are solving their own problems, that to me is the most likely to succeed because they will not stop.
Yeah. And the most likely to succeed means the most likely to drive innovation, change, behavioral patterns, something that is kind of hopefully incrementally or step function better in the world.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then even when you get into, say, B2B SaaS products, the ones that work are the ones that have been started by folks who have used the legacy systems and have just had it up to here. And they're going to build something that actually works, damn it.
You know, I feel like you've pretty much explained the entire Seattle startup ecosystem, or at least how it started. But okay, so this is really interesting because let's come back to this question that I was getting asked right earlier today, this proactive versus reactive nature. Mm-hmm. I'm going to posit that you're positing. So I'm putting words in your mouth. I'm going to posit that you're saying humans are inherently reactive in their problem solving, but that curiosity, that drive to do better, that drive to like proactively change something for the better, not be happy with the status quo, is critical. Because without that, we would just be kind of wallowing in our unhappiness and those processes that haven't changed in 30 years.
And there are plenty of people who don't start companies.
Sure.
And that is fine. Not everyone should do this. It's kind of miserable.
What? somebody has to be a customer.
Yes.
Yes.
But not everyone should do this. And then not everyone should do this all the time. Sometimes you have a day job, and then at some point you have something that bothers you enough that you have to go fix it. Or you have something that just sounds so cool you have to go play with it. But that's frequently transient. You do that and then you figure out what you're going to do next.
Yeah.
There are a certain number of people who like the process and are serial entrepreneurs. That's also fine. Right? They discover that that's their superpower is making things like this work. Maybe they figure out how fundraising works. Maybe they really, really love running small companies or getting from, say, 0 to 1.
Yep.
I think that we would probably see more of that if we had a more supportive infrastructure that, for example, didn't tie healthcare to your employment, that would allow more experimentation. But social safety net is a different discussion for a different time. But that said, risk taking is a big part of it.
So I want to connect this back to the larger organization. So a bunch of the folks that are going to be listening to this pod mm-hmm. are sitting in Fortune 500 enterprises. Some of them are going to be government sector. And they're sitting there thinking, I need to tap into this fire hose of ideas. I need to tap into the energy of entrepreneurs and startups. And frankly, I just need to keep up with the change in the world because it's crazy and nobody can actually do it. But damn it, I'm going to try. So they're thinking that.
So you know the first thing I tell people who want to do this?
Yeah.
Is you should read more science fiction.
And who do you recommend?
I would recommend that you just start with the Hugo winners for the last however many years. Don't start with the ancient classics unless you have someone to guide you through because some of those don't age well. But fundamentally, there are people who spend their time thinking about what the future could be. And they play with all of these things. And you should be reading this. You should be watching science fiction because this will get your brain thinking, what if, right? What could be possible? Because the whole point is to break you out of your comfort zone. Because otherwise you'll spend the entire time thinking inside the box. But again, go widely. So I have a really good example here.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us, because I was going to get all esoteric.
This is actually my husband's example. So he was in the MIT Media Lab, and I was working across the street in the biology building. And the cool thing about the Media Lab in the early 2000s was there were all of these sponsors, and they would walk through, and at any given time, you could have to stop what you were doing and explain what you were doing to someone who might be from DARPA, who might be from Hallmark, who might be from Lego. You never knew. And so you had to be able to explain your work at all these different levels. My husband's work, he was doing 3D printed circuitry in the same lab that created E-Ink.
Okay.
And so DARPA was funding his work. And so when DARPA came through, right, DARPA is the U.S. military's crazy advanced projects idea lab.
Yep.
Their whole job is to think about what the future might look like. So they would come in and they'd brainstorm. And they would say, how about this thing just like in Die Hard? And everyone in the lab, who of course spent most of their time doing things like reading science fiction, felt like this was maybe not the most creative approach. They said, what if you used e-ink to paint a fake door on the wall, like in Looney Tunes? That's really where you're going to go with this.
Okay, I want to go there.
Well, hang on a second. And so then Eric started naming off a whole bunch of things. And they said, oh, that's great. That's amazing. What great, where are you getting all these ideas? And he said, I read Dune.
Wow.
This is one book from several decades ago.
Yep.
Y'all should branch out. Read more. Don't just rely on old movies. But it was apparently mind-blowing.
The story is incredible.
But the point is, go broad and leverage other people's creativity.
I mean, actually, isn't that just a lesson of innovation and entrepreneurship everywhere? Like, your serendipitous collisions don't have to happen at a conference. They can happen in the, you know, in the dark while you're reading on your Kindle, your e-ink device.
Right. Particularly if you're an introvert, that's a great way to put new ideas into your brain. And so I try and I actually flip between fiction and nonfiction books to make sure that I'm getting really interesting inputs, broadening my perspective. And also, as I'm dealing with lots of companies and lots of different spaces, I want to know enough to be dangerous when it comes to any of these topics that they're working on.
Nice. Well, I'll throw in a little pitch here. The Culture Series.
Oh.
The Glitter Band.
Yeah, Ian Banks.
Yeah, Ian M. Banks. I don't know why that's in my head right now, but entertaining and full of crazy ideas. Social ideas as well as technological.
Absolutely. But I love the idea that you'll frequently find one little change. And what happens if you make this one little change? And the answer is usually everything.
Amazing. So, no, this is really cool. So we've gotten a little sci-fi recommendation. I mean, honestly, I think that's incredibly good advice to sort of broaden the mind, understand the art of what's possible in the discussion. What about kind of everyday tactical advice? So when you see startups interact with people that are working in larger organizations, mm-hmm. what's some of the advice you give to both parties to make for a successful interaction?
Well, to startups, I ask them to modify their expectations.
It's important.
Because a large company cannot move at the same pace as a startup.
And probably should not.
Yes, absolutely should not, because they are beholden to their current users, their current customers. And also the legal risk is very, very different. If you're a giant multinational, you have employees in all of these different countries. And if you screw up, the penalties are potentially huge. Versus, say, there are five of us and we're working out of a garage in Oakland. That's a very different situation. So be a little bit of thoughtful about what they need in terms of speed, in terms of making sure that you are meeting requirements around safety and security and reliability. Because what your comfort level is as a startup may not match, you know, we need 5 9s, bare minimum, before we try anything. That's a different set of requirements. So sometimes that means you do not start selling to large customers. You do not start a POC with a large customer. You start with someone smaller who can actually manage risk with you, or you find a way to do a POC with a large company that tests things out in a low-risk situation. For large companies, the advice is to make sure that you actually have a reasonable method for onboarding and testing things that come from small companies. That means you create a sandbox.
Yep.
If you're going to acquire companies, creating a sandbox, don't just throw them in and watch them die.
Means you need to actually have a contracting process that doesn't bury them.
Yes. But again, there's two different modes here. There's acquisition, and then there's testing and POC and early stage partnership. So you may have a two-tiered system. You may say, we can test in this geo, or we can test with a sandbox data set. Maybe we aren't even testing with real live customers. But you need to find a way to try things that are new and that are outside your comfort zone. Otherwise, you will not keep up, and one of these startups is going to eat your lunch. So figure out a way to test. And then if you find that this is a good match, bring them on board, expand. And again, this means incrementally expand. You don't go from here is my small test of 5,000 customers to, and then we're rolling it out to 50 million. You have some incremental stages in between to make sure that the scaling works.
Well, that's actually a really good point, because that is hard, mm-hmm. right? When you're operating inside of a multinational, you are naturally thinking about efficiency at scale. Like, I've been there. I spent years at Microsoft, and we were talking about small changes that impact a billion people or 5 billion people. And, you know, that is almost like diametrically opposed to testing large changes with a small number of people that we do in the startup world. So that is a really interesting tension point that you identified.
Well, and also to make a difference for a large company, to reach materiality, yeah. you've got to have a huge impact.
Yep, that's true. Okay, I've got one more question for you on the advice front. So I think I may have shared this with you before. I can't remember, but there's a framework that I used to use when I was in corporate hiring people to work with startups. And there's an interview question I would use. I would actually ask them a very simple question. I would say, hey, curiosity, credibility, or compassion. What's the most important for working with startups and why? So I'm curious, Christy, for your thoughts on these C's, because we talked about curiosity. I don't know, you can take credibility, compassion, whatever. But what of those attributes, or maybe another attribute if you think it's better, do you need to have inside of a large corporation if you're going to be able to successfully work with startups?
You said creativity?
I said curiosity, credibility, and compassion, but you can pick any letter. It doesn't even have to start, or any word. It doesn't even have to start with C.
None of those are seeing to, I would say flexibility.
Flexibility, okay.
Flexibility or creativity?
Talk to me about that. Like, we talked a little bit about the flexibility of being able to work with an early stage company, breakthrough processes, you know, bite off small parts. But like, what is it? How do you be flexible when you're working at an Autodesk, a PepsiCo, a GE, a whatever?
So there's always more than one path to success. One of those paths is very, very well marked, well signposted. And if you work in a large company, that's the path you're used to walking.
Yep.
The question is there another way to get there? And if you're going to work with startups, you need to figure out all of those other paths, because they're not going to be able to walk down the well signposted, well lit path to a successful outcome.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that fundamentally you have to be able to think outside of the standard box and say, this is, again, how can we test this in a way that is time and cost efficient? How can we work together in a way that will lead to an understanding of what we should do next? But fundamentally, you have to be able to problem solve in a way that does not conform to standard large company thinking.
Yep.
Because that's the only way that you're going to be able to bring some of these new solutions on board, because the whole point is they do not fit. That is the entire point.
That's a really important point.
If they fit, they would not be changing the culture and they would not be changing the process.
Amazing. That's a really important point. The whole point is that these innovative ideas, these startups, these founders do not fit in the large organization.
Yeah.
And that is in fact the reason that we're working with them. I like that. Well, okay. So we're running out of time here, but I want to take you in a completely different direction for our last little bit here. There's a lot changing in the world, and you hit on our need for sort of curiosity. You hit on the need for sort of resources to think about this. Let's talk about just kind of dealing with change. So, and this is a question of how we think about what change should exist. It's a question of ethics. You talk with a lot of startups. How often does an ethical consideration come up in your conversation? And what does that look like?
Well, first of all, I do have a background in bioethics. So this is a space that my brain goes quite a bit. Second, it depends on the type of startup. Some startups are born from ethical considerations.
Okay.
So again, referring back to those CSW companies that are all mission-driven companies, most of them were born out of ethical concerns. So things like, how might we save the lives of people when they are using opioids? How might we improve the result of police encounters with civilians, particularly civilians of color? How might we increase the success of wound healing in diabetic patients? Right. So all of these are trying to have a specific ethical outcome, and that's basically baked in. I see it much less when you have someone who's just so into their tech. And that really speaks to why it's important to have a variety of people in the room. If it's just me, the only experience that I have is the stuff that's in my head.
So there's an emergent ethical normalization or a framework that can come out from having multiple people.
Multiple people with different backgrounds. And that can be
diverse backgrounds. Yeah, okay.
Diverse backgrounds does not just mean DEI, right?
No, diversity.
Yes, there's gender, there's ethnic background. There's also age. There's also geographic representation worldwide. There's urban versus rural. There is what subject matter expertise do you bring? And so having a wide variety of people with diverse experience along many axes is super important because, first of all, that means that someone's more likely to flag an issue. They will notice something that you won't. Mm-hmm. I generally try to interrogate my biases for blind spots. I will miss things because I don't know what I don't know. So that means several things. That means I need to surround myself with a variety of people, and I need to get my product out and test it with real humans. And I need to see how it lands with them. I need to get their feedback. And not just, do you like it? Would you buy it? But does this actually solve a real problem? Does it cause other problems that I'm not seeing? Could you play with it a little bit and then get back to me? Right? Some open-ended questions. And again, this doesn't mean that I just give it to my friends and family. This means that I go find a random selection of people in the areas that I might look for customers. So if I'm looking in the US, I'm going to look for people who are, again, urban versus rural, different ages, different job descriptions, different education levels, different ethnic and cultural backgrounds, as wide a variety as I can.
And, you know, I think one of the things that I'm hearing under what you're saying is that these questions come up often, whether it's sort of overt or kind of under the radar, but you know, this question or the need to sort of think about this comes up fairly frequently when you're talking to startups.
It does, because there's always unforeseen consequences. The more impactful the technology, the more unforeseen consequences.
Yeah.
Right. As we're playing with generative AI, you're seeing a lot of this.
Yep.
There's even some of the classics, like the folks who made some of the sensors underneath the paper towel dispensers. They don't read dark or pigmented skin well, because none of the people who were doing this had dark or pigmented skin.
Yep.
So they never thought to test it.
Yep.
Again, you don't know what you don't know, but the faster you get it out in the wild, the better you're going to learn what unexpected things crop up. But you never know how people are going to use your stuff. And quite frankly, there's potential downsides, but there's also huge potential upsides, because frequently, the best use case is one that you as the creator did not envision. And I find that really cool.
Well, I love that about the potential of innovation, of entrepreneurship and startups is, the best use case might be something you never even thought about. And that's a good reason to engage in this, actually. It's a really good reason just to connect with startups, because you don't know.
Well, I love that kind of surprise.
It's a good surprise. Well, Christy, thanks for joining. Man, we kind of covered a lot of ground in a short period of time, but some really, really interesting topics here to consider. For people who want to stay connected with you, where should they go? They follow you on LinkedIn? Are you tweeting or Xing these days, or whatever we're calling it? Like, what's the best way?
LinkedIn works well. The site formerly known as Twitter, I usually use as a consumption tool, not a broadcast tool. And I'm investigating Blue Sky as well. We'll see. Social media is not really my thing. But probably LinkedIn.
All right. Well, stay connected to Christy Canada on LinkedIn and follow her work, of course, with Alchemist Accelerator. Christy, thanks for joining for this conversation. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Ian.
Have a good one.
So that's a wrap for today's episode of Alchemist X Innovators Inside. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you found value and insight in today's discussion, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone who is passionate about corporate innovation or just curious about great ideas and practical insights. Until next time, I'm Ian Bergman. Thanks for tuning in.